of our conference will consist in a successive presentation of the issues of representation, heritage and diversity in post-colonial nations, and more particularly still in two former settler colonies, namely Canada and Australia. And we decided to focus on two main issues which could be each developed concerning both Australia and Canada, but we have deliberately decided to focus more on each for each part. So for the Australian part, we'll focus more on the question of First Nations and the Indigenous voice, the Indigenous voices, actually. And then on the part on Canada, we'll focus more, my colleague will focus more on the question of multiculturalism. And the question of the First Nations and multiculturalism as related to the question of how do we build a national identity, how do we make sure that the heritage represents all communities within the nation and that sufficient diversity is assured. So as far as I'm concerned, I will focus more particularly, and this corresponds, I'm sure you've started flipping through the booklet, the two first sets of documents, with one first set of documents on the Indigenous voice and the other one on the representation of Indigenous Australians, and especially not just, let me be more precise. One of the issues with national identity is that this is something, especially in former settler colonies, that was set up by people who were not originally from the place. The settlers, they arrive in a new place and they try and connect with the land and they try and invent a tradition, a heritage, a culture for their new country, new adopted country. So to that extent, by definition, it excludes First Nations, it excludes native people. I've started with a very beautiful quote by an extraordinary poet, Australian, Indigenous Australian poet, namely Ujirunu Nopal. She's on the left of the picture. And here it is. Let no one say the past is dead, the past is all about us and within. So for Indigenous Australians, the past, the present, the future, they're all interlinked, they cannot be separate. And it's really essential for society to remember its past. So we will see that Indigenous artists not only manage to perpetuate their culture and values and share them more broadly than within their own Indigenous community, but that they also seize upon non-Indigenous representations and especially national archetypes and try and insert themselves within such iconic figures. Because as I was saying a minute ago, when you first try to build a national identity from scratch for the first settlers, the British settlers, this excludes the Aboriginal people. And there has been an attempt on many Indigenous Australians to actually reappropriate such a canon, such a set, such a cluster of national figures, and so as to remind the rest of the Australian community that we've been there all along and we should be in such representations, not just in our own representation, so to speak, but I'll give you more examples later on and you'll see what I mean by that. So they appropriate and they reinterpret national icons and role models that were originally non-Indigenous and quite exclusive to that extent. This will be the occasion to work on one of the most recurrent and popular iconic figures that, for those of you who are already familiar with Australian culture and identity, must be familiar with, namely the drover's wife. And this is an extraordinary figure, archetypal figure, because it was there right from the start, right from the very first writings that were published in the very nationalist bulletin, and yet it had this characteristic that right from the start it was not that conventional, because first of all this was a woman, and most national archetypes were male figures. And this has given rise to a whole series of reinterpretations, but we'll see that later on. For this first talk, I've decided to give you a lot of open questions for you to think about together with your students and to further develop in your own future classes. Each of them, or several combined, could serve as the backbone or the red thread to your various class sequences. And among the most important and recurrent issues, here are a few that you will necessarily have to tackle at one point. What is the First Nation? How can we characterize First Nations voices? So how can we characterize First Nations voices? Can Indigenous people speak? Who were the most striking spokesmen and spokeswomen in the long and ongoing fight for the Aboriginal voice to pierce through? And how can First Nation people represent themselves and their communities? And all of this very closely corresponds to the following entries in your own syllabus. So first things first, what is a nation? The very concept of nations, and more particularly nation states, emerged at the end of the 18th century in the West and was part of an attempt to organize political life and settle geopolitical rivalries and possible conflicts around the concept of a nation as an abstract entity representing the interests of its people. The idea is that every single member of a nation state, whatever their gender, social class, ethnicity, was supposed to feel they all belonged to the national community and the nation could guarantee it would defend their respective interests equitably. The nation had to be neutral and not detrimental to any citizen. In democratic nation states, citizens vote and thus make sure their interests are being fully taken into account, protected and defended. With Australia, as you all know, this was very problematic because Indigenous Australians only got the right to vote in 1967. This is just incredible. So right from the beginning, the very concept of nation is abstract and imaginary, and one should not forget the community of citizens is an imagined community. Imaginations, images. This is built on images. Images, representations are very important to the cohesion within a nation and should really be carefully handled. So Benedict Anderson, who worked on such issues of national, having to do with national identity and how to create a sense of cohesion and unity within a nation, speaks of those imagined communities in this groundbreaking book that he published in 1991. And he has this to say: an imagined political community is imagined because the members of even the smallest nation will never know most of their fellow members, meet them or even hear of them, yet in the minds of each lives the image of their communion. And he also further insists on the fact that this is supposed to avoid possible conflict. So nations rely on images, images of the communion of its members, and this should create a sense of cohesion and unity within the country. National identity relies on such inherited images, which will evolve over time, so as to be more inclusive of new members, or, paradoxically, of members whose existence and citizenship had been denied before. And this is the case in many settler colonies, as we all know, of many former settler colonies, of many countries who used to be settler colonies. And the, so if we take the definition, Anthony Smith's definition of national identity now, which is a very convenient one to give to your students when you're working on the question of nationhood, the idea of national identity. Here is how he defines it. This is based on a historic territory or homeland, common myths and historical memories, a common mass public culture, common legal rights and duties for all members, a common economy with territorial mobility for members. Well, if you take each element one after the other, you see that they're all contentious when you speak about Indigenous Australians. How can they share common myth and historical memories when the land was declared empty for such a long time? Up until 1992, this was declared the terra nullius. This was the accepted legal doctrine. How can you accept the idea of common historical memories when the very idea of frontier violence was completely denied and when everybody agrees now that in Tasmania there is a real genocide? So those are very complex and contentious political questions. So why is it so problematic in Australia? First, because precisely there is no consensus on what history or how history took place. There is this what is known in Australia as the history wars, and they've been made all the more acute since the work, the quite thought-provoking and quite unconventional type of historiographical work done by Reynolds. Henry Reynolds, that you see here, he was the first one, the first historian in the 60s to say, hold on in traditional history books, we've very much underestimated the degree of violence in the whole story of settlement. And it's high time that we should revise this, and that we should, as I said here, this is from an article published on the Conversation, from an indigenous perspective. So not just a strictly indigenous perspective, the idea is to remain neutral, but to at least not only see history through a lens that would be purely non-indigenous. So it should be more inclusive. This was made all... there was a real polemic after that, because there was another author here, a lecturer, and a writer, who published a book that was a self-published book, with a very provocative title. That was Keith Windschuttle, and he published The Fabrication, so the forgery, so to speak, of Aboriginal history. So then there were a lot of debates between the two sides, very conservative ones saying, oh, it's all political, saying that we should revise history, let's remain objective, etc. And then the others, more progressive, saying it never was progressive, it's high time that precisely we did some real accurate historical work, that we should, for instance, there are many, at the time, there are many historians who have a much closer look at sites where they find human remains, where there were massacres, etc. So precisely this is done in a very accurate manner to see that, to show that for a very long time the historiography was far from neutral, ideologically speaking, and that actually, indigenous people are often presented as having accepted colonization quite peacefully and without resistance. And what Henry Reynolds shows in his book on the other side of the frontier is that, no, there was resistance. And this is something that should also be said and known for the general public. So whether in historiography, literature, or iconography, it is now a well-accepted fact among both progressive and conservative circles that the importance of indigenous culture, history, and worldviews has been erased or downplayed for a very long time indeed, or at the very least, quite underestimated and very little valorized. If we look, I quote Anthony Smith, at common myths and historical memories, one cannot but admit that Aboriginal people are nowhere to be seen. The most iconic national figures are all non-Indigenous. And this is now leading to a new trend in art, literature, painting, and photography to re-inject such an Indigenous presence and perspective so as to alert the general public to blind spots and blanks in their collective myths and representations. If we take the most recurrent national archetypes, heroes, so to speak, they are, and this will not come as a surprise to you, mostly or exclusively male, except for the drover's wife. That's why this is an interesting figure to study, among others. And they're always non-Indigenous. So I will quote, for those of you who know a lot or quite a lot on Australian culture, this is something you know already. What are the most famous archetypal figures representing what it means to be Australian? The explorer, the drover, the shearer. So the drover, basically this is the equivalent to the American cowboy. He drives the cattle, he drives sheep. The shearer, he shears sheep, donc le tondeur de moutons. The bushman, the settler, the pioneer, but also the digger, the one that digs in the mines, but also the soldier, and especially with Anzac. If you take the image of the pioneer, there's no way you could reintroduce an Aboriginal person there. That wouldn't make any sense. They were not pioneers, they were not settlers, they had been living there for tens of thousands of years. So that's perfect, no need to revise anything. But if you take such figures as the shearers, the historical fact is that there were indigenous shearers on cattle stations. So why not represent them ever? So there is this new tendency in art these days when it's obvious that the very presence of indigenous people has been systematically effaced to reintroduce them. So Diane Jones, who is an extraordinary artist, She's decided, for instance, to take the example of the shearer. But before I show you what Diane Jones did with the original, let's say a few words about the original. The original, it is this one. This is a real household picture that any Australian will know. This is a very idealized representation of mateship, the pleasure of working together, the idea of fraternity, the idea of work that remains pleasant. You have this soft light, you have a type of work that is adapted to each generation. You can see that the elderly man on the right is crouching, just surveying what is going on. He's too old for any harsh or very heavy physical work. Then you have the young boys. They are here again doing things that are much easier, like this boy carrying wool and the other sweeping the floor. And I found this was interesting when I looked at what Diane Jones did with this first painting. I was really struck by the fact that she's completely put the little boy's face in the shade, and I found this intriguing, and I wondered why. And then I thought, wow, this is quite interesting actually, because as is the case in a lot of Norman Rockwell's pictures, where you often have a face, a smiley face, a cheery face, looking back at you, creating a sense of intimacy and connection and bond that is really almost unconscious. This is something that is on the emotional level. You definitely have this in the original picture by Tom Roberts, with this only face, cheery face, looking back at us, this young boy. And precisely in putting him in the shade, this enables us to see what was not seen. The fact that there were actually indigenous people working on as shearers. And actually, Diane Jones' own family members, in their own time, worked on such where she raised themselves. So she's deliberately chosen two members of her own family to pose for her. So on the left, you have two members of her family. They are not shearers right now, but this is a way to pay tribute to a side of history that has been completely effaced, erased, or underestimated. So this is just one example, but actually, even before the work of artists, when you have such books as this quite extraordinary book that actually you can borrow at the library here, I had it ordered a few years ago, by Newke and Shoemaker on Aboriginal Australians, they really show you that actually in the first 60 years of the 20th century in Australia, it's estimated that there were up to 10,000 indigenous people working on such cattle stations. And yet they are nowhere to be seen in iconography, in photography, in literature, whether ballads, poems, novels, nowhere. Very often the Australian landscape was portrayed, especially by painters of the Heidelberg School at the beginning of the 20th century, as the ideal place for new settlers, free settlers, to arrive into. So the idea was to focus on water, the fact that it would be perfect for sheep grazing, a bucolic Arcadian landscape. And actually another member from the Heidelberg School of Painters, Frederick McCubbin, loved this painting and said, oh, you could almost take this picture as a national symbol. Yes, pastoralism is really strong in Australian identity, especially in the first decades towards in the next decades of in the last decades of the 19th century up to federation. And so this leads us to the question having to do with who usually represents the nation's heritage, to come back to the idea at the beginning, heritage, representation, heritage and diversity. Who usually represents the nation's heritage? Is there any diversity involved in such representation? How can the indigenous subalterns speak or offer their visions of the Australian nation? One of the main problems with national representations in former settler colonies is that they are first circulated by non-Indigenous people arriving in a new place they try to connect with and invent national mythologies about, what Lyotard would call grand narratives, les métarécits. Here, this would correspond to the grand narrative of the hardworking laborer or the heroic shearer or drover, also with a strong focus on Christianity, civilization. And even if indigenous people had been given the opportunity to speak from their own perspective about their community's culture and values, there was another added complication, which is the issue of assimilation. All along the 20th century, and this started from the end of the 19th century, there was this systematic policy that was enforced on indigenous people, which was that of assimilation. And this was even more violent and systematic if you were born mixed race. As you know, there was this whole policy about assimilation that was extremely violent, that is known as the stolen generations policies. So these policies consisted in basically kidnapping the young ones from their families so as to make sure that they would get a proper education, non-indigenous education, so they would be forbidden to speak their own language, they would be forbidden to even speak about their culture or their families. So there was really a quite violent conditioning into this is the past, you have to cut yourself off from the past and move forward and assimilate. So for mixed-race children, this was made compulsory and even more violent with this assimilative policies with the stolen generations. Some of you might have seen, and if not, this is something that would work really well with students, but I've heard, and I'm quite happy about that, that some of you are already working on this. The rabbit proof lens is an excellent one for that. And I'm sure, and we can discuss this, if some of you have used it in class, I would be really interested to see how you go about it and what works, doesn't work so well, and how it could work better. And so the main problem was for indigenous people to speak in their own name and voice about their culture, which they consider as never solely belonging to the past, present, or future, but as a continuous space-time in which transmission of one's heritage through songs, dream tracks, and ceremonies, corroborees, is essential in ensuring the social and spiritual well-being of the whole community. So if we now pass to the main indigenous voices, who were the major indigenous Australian voices? I've chosen three main ones, Noonuffle, Kim Scott, and Alexis Wright, and not just because Alexis Wright was on the aggregation curriculum, but just because she's just such an extraordinary figure. I'm not the only one. We were all so impressed by her style, her heart. Actually, this will be a red thread, the heart, the beating heart of the indigenous culture. And she, just like Ujuru Noonuffle, they are people who can really make the world evolve in the right direction. So Ujuru Noonuffle is usually considered the first major Indigenous Australian poet. Her poetry was extremely accessible and militant. I'm sure you've seen that the very first text, the very first poem in your booklet, is a poem by Noonuffle, The Dispossessed. This is a poem full of anger and disillusionment. And I thought it would be really important, especially for such a subject, that I should not be the only one speaking, but that you should at least listen to a great indigenous lady speak for herself and her people. So this will just be 1 minute and 30 seconds that I couldn't do without.
I wrote The Dispossessed in the early 60s when we were trying to gather up people to form the civil rights movement. And what inspired me to write The Dispossessed was there were those in the political world who were extreme left-wingers and there was extreme right-wingers, the Aboriginals were right in the middle, and they were all trying to get possession of the Aboriginal people. And this has been going on for the last 200 years. You know, they talk about the Aboriginals as our blacks. So I stood up and said, why don't you just stop and ask the Aborigines what they want? And of course, everything broke loose. And I went out very disillusioned and very bitter and very angry. And I went home that night and I put down in draft form a poem, which finally became The Dispossessed. The condition for Aboriginals during that period of time was very bad. We have the highest rate of infant mortality in the world. We still have it. 17 of our children dies against one in the white world in this lucky country called Australia. We have the highest leprosy rate in the world in Western Australia in this so-called lucky country. Now, in the Australian years BC, and by that I mean before Cook, we were a disease-free race of people. And all these diseases came in. I heard the voices of my people, and every time I heard a story like that, I went home and I wrote a poem about it.
And what is quite extraordinary is that most of her poems are not just full of anger and disillusionment, but full of hope. And there is one poem in particular in which she says, this is called Son of Mine, I could tell you of heartbreak, hatred blind, but I'll tell instead of brave and fine when lives of black and white entwined, and men in brotherhood combined, this I would tell you, son of mine. So a great dignity of this woman, always putting forward hope and a desire for conciliation, reconciliation between the two communities. And Alexis Wright, paying her respects to her in an article, Rebel Voice, in which she said that Ujuru recorded the heartbeat and soul of our people of that time, not only in an elegant and humane way, but also as pure propaganda, which was what she once called her writing, not the best, but the best-selling. So she was ready to run the risk of being called that poet as long as her message got through. Among certain poems that you could definitely use in your own classes, there is this one that is very well-known and that is very binary. And it almost sounds as if you could take every line and put it on a sign and go marching in the streets. There is this one that I'm sure the students would love because this showcases and puts into the limelight a very courageous and brave female Indigenous woman who is a horse rider, a very good horse rider in her time, and who marched to obtain the right for Indigenous people to get paid for their job. Because basically they were just given food and that was it. And she wanted this to change. So I've given you various sources to know more about her. She's also written a very good why did I put this? I was intrigued. Maybe some of you know this series by Penelope Bagieu by heart. Is there a page on Ujuru Nunavut? Because I felt she would be so great in that kind of book. I would have to check. I haven't checked yet. But if not, maybe we could suggest it to Penelope Bagieu. there is this website, the ABC Fierce Girls website, that is really interesting to look into also with the students. Albert Namajira, he was very famous in his own time because he was an Indigenous artist who was taught by a Western painter how to use watercolours. So his type of art was much more accessible to non-Indigenous people, and he became extremely popular and extremely well-known internationally in his time. But this was before the civil rights movement had gained any more significant rights for the Indigenous Australians, and namely also, in particular, the right to vote. So he had a very tragic life story. Maybe some of you know about that. He got very rich, but as he was not a citizen, as he was not part of the census, he could not vote, he could not buy a house, he could not even buy alcohol. So it made people outraged, especially internationally, to realize that such a great artist was treated as a dog, really. So there was an exception made for him, and he was made a citizen. So he bought alcohol, and a friend of his was at the back of his car and started grabbing a bottle. And Namajira was arrested for that, and he was put into jail. So it broke his heart. He actually died in the next 2 years. So this idea of heartbreak or heart beating, I think it is something that is a red thread that he could use. But I can say more about this later on. So she also wrote a very beautiful poem about Namajira. Aboriginal man, you walked with pride and painted with joy the countryside. Namajira, they boomed your art. So they, non-Indigenous Australians and non-Indigenous people worldwide, they boomed your art, they called you genius, then broke your heart. Another tribute paid by Alexis White to Noonuccal, saying that really Noonuccal is where the heart of Aboriginal consciousness lies, that place where our spirit is kept alive with memories, our constant source of light, hope for the future and defying some troubled times. So who else should we definitely mention? Well, all the extraordinary writers who wrote biographies, life stories. Among the most well-known are Doris Pilkington's The Rabbit Proof Fence, which gave rise to this internationally acclaimed film later on. There is also a less well-known and very poetic and very moving novel that is inspired from the author's own family story, but it's not autobiographical, Benang. And I've given you an excerpt also, and this is called Benang from the Heart again. And there are countless others that I could give you if you're interested. And I also wanted to say a few words about the various activists that fought very concretely for political decisions to be made to redress the injustices that were still affecting the Indigenous Australians. And among such injustices was the fact that it was quite common, for instance, in swimming pools, to refuse access to Indigenous people. And this sometimes gave rise to situations that were completely absurd, even more absurd and ridiculous than they were at the beginning, which is that in the same family, depending on whether you had a darker skin tone or a lighter one, some brothers or sisters would be accepted and the others would be refused. So there was this Indigenous activist, this man, Charles Perkins, who thought, oh, this is great because this is so absurd. I'm sure if I can make this known, not only in Australia, but worldwide, this will make things change. So he convinced some of his fellow friends who were students with him at the university to go on a bus ride, a 15-day bus ride, and go to this swimming pool, and strike outside, stand outside the swimming pool and ask for this to be stopped. And there was a lot of publicity around this, and obviously this succeeded. There were also actions by the Black Power movement. Actually, one of the leaders, a very handsome leader at that, is actually the son of Ujuru Noonuccal. She was actually called Kath Walker. He's called Dennis Walker. The main difference between the Black Power version in Australia was that there were much more less violence, nothing like the Black Panthers, but really much more into education and peaceful type of marches or protests. And lastly, I'll just give you a few indications about the Indigenous Voice to Parliament that I'm sure you've heard of. That was something that was suggested, and there was a referendum on this last autumn. This idea from a lot of Indigenous groups that it was high time that this was inscribed in the Australian Constitution, that there must be, whatever law is being passed, a body of Indigenous people, Indigenous representatives that can have their say. It would only have been consultative, so it was no real threat, but even that was actually not voted, which is very sad and quite worrying for the future. So I've given you references here to one. This is a short piece that is really interesting. This is when Prime Minister Anthony Albanese pleads for his fellow countrymen to have common sense and to at least grant that, and he's tearful because this is so little to grant after all the injustices that the indigenous Australians have been suffering from, and even that was denied. And a very interesting also article from The Guardian here. And lastly, I would have liked to speak about that, but we'll have time to discuss this in the second part, a more interactive part, about precisely representations. The Drover's Wife, originally Henry Lawson's short story. Then a first interpretation that is a bit absurdist in tonality by Drysdale. Another one that could be that you could imagine in the States, very idealized. And this one by an indigenous woman, an extraordinary woman. She's a playwright. She's a filmmaker. She's an actress, and she's a very inspiring figure. And here, this is The Drover's Wife, the legend of Molly Johnson. That there would be a lot to say, but I'll let you think about it in the second set of documents. And that those are guidelines for the analysis of documents that I'll show you later on when you'll be working yourself on the set of documents. But now I would like to let my colleague present everything he has to tell you about multiculturalism in Canada.